that you sent to me. You found a way of making a mini website out of that thing. Why don't you give us that website address one more time, Paul, so that other people can easily see that picture. You can go to NASA.gov or JWST, James Webb Space Telescope, JWST.NASA.gov, and you'll eventually fiddle around and find a whole series of pictures, and one of them is this beautiful picture of this full-size mock-up on the front end of the NASA Space Center in Maryland. But that mini website you gave us last week, would you give us that one again, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, I think I gave that to you a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, I shrunk it down. It was way too big. So I like that tiny URL site. Very good for that. So that's http://tiny, T-I-N-Y, .cc, that's Charlie, / 8, that's the number 8, S-W-I-K, Sierra Whiskey, India, Kilo. So, again, http://, T-I-N-Y, .cc, / 8, S-W-I-K. And, I like to describe it. I mean, over radio, you know, we described it many, many times. The size of a 707 or the size of a tennis court, you know, that's a good way to do it. But when you look at this picture, you realize they're going to put this thing out four times the distance of the moon, and it's going to open up. This origami contraption is going to open up and hopefully never be serviced. So don't look good to be serviced out that far. Dick, did you ever go to the site I told you where you could see this thing? You know, put it up on your computer and you could watch this thing open up. Did you get that?
I sure did. There's a whole series of YouTube videos. When you go to JWST.NASA.gov and you look at all of the various things you can branch into, quite a few of them are NASA-made movies of the unfurling of this thing. This James Webb Space Telescope all folds up like origami, like he said, like paper folding, all fits inside of the launch vehicle. And it's going to be sent close to 1,000,000 miles away from the Earth at the Lagrange point number 2, that's the one that's 1,000,000 miles further from the Earth than the Sun, on the backside of the Earth, so to speak. And that's where it's going to sit for a lot of years once it goes out there and does its thing. And it's going to have a lot more sensitivity than Hubble, and it's going to have primarily infrared sensitivity. I think that goes from something like the lower end of the video range. Let me drop. I think the thing goes from something like 0.6 microns out to 23 microns. That's the wavelength it'll cover. That's both very near and medium and starting to get into far infrared. The advantage of infrared is it penetrates clouds, so you're going to be able to see the birthing of stars and planets by looking through those clouds and watching the action. Getting back now to those other spacecraft like Voyager and Pioneer that Paul's been telling us about. Pluto is out there at 39 astronomical units, 39 times the distance between Earth and Sun, 93 million miles. So Pluto is out there 3.6 billion miles. Voyager is out there something in the vicinity of 85 astronomical units. That's around 8 billion miles. At the speed of light, one-way communication, that signal has to go for 12 hours roughly to get there. We're talking about 12, 15 type hours one way at the speed of light. That transmitter on board is a traveling wave tube that in the beginning was putting out 10 watts of power. Now because the nuclear, let me drop. The nuclear power supply is falling off in voltage output and the tube is aging. I think it's down to 5 or 6 watts of output. 5 or 6 watts of output, 8 billion miles away. At the speed of light, something like 12 to 15 hours, one way, for the signal to get here. There are lots of people saying, you can't do that. They know about the inverse square law. Every time you double the distance between you and the signal that's being transmitted to you, you get one quarter of the amount of power. And how many doublings does it take to get all the way out there at 8 billion miles? You know, twice or three times the distance of Pluto. It's hard to believe that you can get a signal that weak. By way of that 8.5 gigahertz dish that's a few feet in diameter that's on the spacecraft, precisely aimed at the Earth, and by way of a 240-foot dish at Goldstone, California, aimed at it with a super low noise parametric amplifier at the front end, cryogenically cooled, you're able to get these signals. If you tell the transmitter on Voyager, A, the signal's getting weak, so you have to go to a smaller number of bits per second, which means that the instantaneous bandwidth of the signal gets smaller and smaller. So it's transmitting a smaller number of bits per second, and you narrow up the receiver so it's only a couple of kilohertz wide or even less, and now you can suck that signal out of the noise and get the data as to what it's measuring, and you can give it commands. Let me drop this. And can you imagine the process of giving a command to Voyager? As I've told you guys once before, let's assume now that it takes 14 hours one way. You're going to give this whole great big series of computer-generated characters that give Voyager a command. And you got to be damn careful you don't give it the wrong command, because if it aims that dish in the wrong direction, not toward Earth, you'll never talk to it again. Maybe it's got a saving mode. If it doesn't hear from the Earth for a few days, it knows to go back to what it used to do. I'm not sure if it does that. But to make sure you don't do something that's a goof, you give it a whole series of commands, and you tell it, I'm going to send you commands. Record these commands, but do not do it yet. And after I'm finished sending you the commands, send it back to me. Tell me what you heard. So 14 hours will say up, 14 hours back down. You get the signal back down a day and a half later, and you study the signal and say, uh-huh, it got it correctly. There's no errors in that signal. Then you send another signal back up. Okay, you got it correct. Now go do it. You got to be real careful with you transmitting a signal like that, because ain't nobody ever going to go out there and repair that thing. Ain't nobody ever going to see it again. It's really out of this world. To transmit radio over those distances, you'd be amazed how many people I've talked to who said, radio can't do that. The signal's going to get too weak, it's below the noise, and you can't listen to it. Well, how weak can you listen to a signal? If the signal is sufficiently coherent, in other words, it's really got an exact frequency, let me drop. It's got an exact frequency, and you know that frequency. It's got an exact direction, and you've got a high-gain pencil beam antenna aimed in that direction. And your receiver is set at exactly the right frequency with the right bandwidth. How weak can you listen to a signal? Dr. Tom Williams, WA1MBA, when we sent ourselves a whole series of emails one day calculating how weak could a signal be. I mean, when I was listening to the Apollo astronauts on Apollo 15 and 16, I was listening to a signal of around minus 120 dBm. You try to set your Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator down that far, and the dial don't go that weak. With a 12-foot diameter dish and a low-noise parametric amplifier at 2 gigahertz, 2.3 gigs, I was listening to the Apollo spacecraft while it's going around the moon. That was the command module and the lunar module that landed on the moon and the lunar rover car and the ALSEP of Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Packages. I was listening to all of those S-band signals, all those 2.3 gig signals, because I was using a frequency-synthesized receiver, which happened to be a spectrum analyzer doing the main front-end tuning after the preamplifier, and the 12-foot dish aimed directly at the moon. I was listening to those signals, and I thought I was listening to something really weak. Well, NASA listens to things that are 1,000 times weaker than that, and maybe even beyond. So with the right frequency sensitivity, with the right coherence, with the right bandwidth, with the right method of modulation, there is no real limit. That radio signal you send out goes to everywhere in the universe. It keeps getting weaker and weaker, but it's always there. It goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe once you send out a signal. Let me drop. And as you've heard me discuss so many times in the past, the only thing left to discuss is when the signal gets there. Is it above the threshold of the receiving equipment that you're using? That's the only thing left to discover. There is no limit. You can't say that the signal is below the noise. It's below whose noise? It's below the noise of your particular receiver system with that particular front-end noise figure that's generating noise. You can always build a quieter receiver with cryogenic techniques and real fancy selection of the actual amplifying device. You can listen to signals that are weaker and weaker. There is no limit per se, at least no really known limit. What we finally discovered is that Tom and I said, what happens if the signal is 1 photon per second? And what is 1 photon at these frequencies we're talking about? It was something like a minus 205 dBm signal, so I remember. Can you listen to 1 photon per second? At first the answer sounds, that's crazy, you can't do that. Well, it turns out the European Space Observatory has done that with their optical telescope in La Salina, Chile, aimed at the Halley's Comet. Halley's Comet is as black as a piece of coal, and it's out there at these kind of distances where we're talking about the Voyager spacecraft. That's at the apogee of Halley's Comet, where it is right now. So you got something as black as a piece of coal. Out at that distance, if you look back at the sun, you would see an extremely dim minor star, if you know what I mean. That amount of reflected light off of that black object coming back down into those telescopes was giving them something like 1 photon per second. And they gathered that signal for a long enough period of time, used techniques to cancel the background light of that telescope in that place on top of the mountain in Chile, and they listened. They actually got a picture of Halley's Comet at the peak of its orbit. We now have the technology that we can look at Halley's Comet continuously, even when it's not spitting out a tail. So how weak a signal can you use?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So if somebody asks you, how weak a signal can you listen to? There is no good answer. The next question is, what equipment are you using? How big is your antenna? How sensitive is your receiver? How big is the bandwidth? How accurately do they know the frequency? In the case of those Voyager spacecraft, they are a deep space network transponder. The frequency it transmits, you would think it would have a great big error because the crystal is drifting and it's aging and the temperature of the crystal is wrong. It does not depend on the crystal on board. The way this genius of a system works is you send it a signal. It uses that signal as the reference. It divides that signal by 240 over 221, an irrational number, and you know the exact frequency you send up to it, therefore you know the exact frequency it's going to send back down to you. The signal has got extremely high accuracy, traceable to the Bureau, because the signal is coming from Mother Earth. The satellite is just a transponder. It's a pipe with an amplifier, a traveling wave tube amplifier. It's a turnaround pipe, if you know what I mean, picking up the signal, modifying it a little bit, and sending it back down after modulating it. So the frequency accuracy is nearly perfect, and you can get extremely accurate range by way of the pseudo-random code you send on the way up, and how long does it take for that pseudo-random code to come back down, and that gives you coarse ranging, and then you can literally count every cycle it went up and every cycle it went down. One cycle at one wavelength, so to speak, at 2.3 gigahertz is something like 4.5 inches. You have a range resolution of 4.5 inches at 8 billion miles. Ain't that a system? Okay. The next person who had a question was Tony. WW2W. Go right ahead with your...
Yeah, launch.
What was that again, Paul?
Years of launch for Pioneer and Voyager.
Yeah, give us a couple of launch years. Go right ahead.
Okay, yeah, you asked before, so New Horizon was not too long ago. That was in 06, and then Pioneer 10 and 11 was in 72 and 73, respectively. And then Voyager 1 and 2 was in 77. I think it's 77. Both went up at that time. So there you go. And that what's nice, it's all on that website. They give you launch dates. They give you the 8 AUs of the 5 spacecraft. And again, that's heavensabove.com / SOLAR, S-O-L-A-R, dash, escape, E-S-C-A-P-E, dot A-S-T. and they constantly update it. I think it's updated daily because it's nothing but a computer program. Back to you, Dick.
KC2RFM.
Go ahead, Alan.
Dick, did you ever record those Apollo transmissions?
Yes, Apollo 15 and Apollo 16. Yes, I did record them. I remember something like 3 hours on Apollo 15 and something like 10 hours of Apollo 16. And some of it is interesting material because I was listening to the downlink audio at a time when they were not connected to the network. So I heard some more candid material from the astronauts, if you know what I mean. You're about to ask me, can I find that tape recording in my pile of stuff? That could be a little bit difficult, but over to you, Alan.
Alan, if you ever do get around to it, I'm sure there's many people who'd like to hear it, for sure. Back to that, case you do or not.
Yeah, some of it has got a lot of blank tape. Some of it has got quite a noisy signal. Some of it's good sounding signal. I sure wish I had the system up and running on Apollo 13. Those transmissions would have been really exciting to listen to because that was a life and death situation. Very close. I almost didn't make it. But Apollo 15 and 16, by astronaut standards, went rather smoothly. And some of the most exciting things there that happened, I've told you guys a couple of them, was where on Apollo 16, the astronauts were at one point taking apart the instrument panel. And NASA told them, please leave it alone. If you do something wrong and create a short circuit, we can't go up there and fix it for you. So astronauts are unusual people. They are formal test pilots that have lived through some life-threatening situations, and they feel that they're invincible. So from time to time, they will do things that are more dangerous than they practiced during the practices, so to speak. And so in space at times, they got a little bit... persnickety, I guess, is one way of looking at it. Alrighty, Tony, WW2W, go right ahead with your question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WGB, just put me on the list.
Okay, you're right after Tony. Go ahead, Tony.
And Wesley and Occidental.
Wesley recognized. Go ahead, Tony.
Yes, sir. Good evening, Dick. Thanks for ringing that. Actually, I have a comment before my question. Sort of a question comment regarding the subject about Voyager. Does it help that the spacecraft is so far out that it's actually at a cooler temperature so there's less noise in the circuitry? And also, at some point you become, Vigo becomes so distant that aiming the antenna back towards Earth is almost like aiming it back at the sun because all the planets sort of bunch up. Thank you.
Yeah, when it comes to what noise figure does the front end of the receiver of Voyager or Pioneer, what do they see? When they were in the nearer portions of the solar system, and during the time that from their point of view the Earth was directly in front of the sun, now you're aiming the antenna at the Earth, the sun is in the background, and the sun is a very dominant hot object, and it makes a lot of noise at these frequencies. So there you're going to suffer quite a bit of receiver desensitization. By the time the thing got out there by the distance of, let's say, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, now you look back at the sun, it's a very dim, minor star, so to speak. The total amount of noise the receiver sees in that direction is kind of small. The whole spacecraft is at a temperature that's starting to get pretty cold, and therefore, the nuclear power supply is supplying the heat and the power to make everything run, and certain portions of the spacecraft have to be heated. The filament of the traveling wave tube, that's heated by the filament voltage, no problem. The traveling wave tube, he doesn't care about being cold. Some of the rest of the electronics doesn't care about being cold. The only thing that really cares about being cold are the individual experiments. An ultraviolet detector, let me drop it. Is going to give you a calibrated output when the detector itself is held at a particular temperature. So they didn't calibrate it at cryogenic temperatures on the Earth because they thought it wasn't going to be operating that way. But it looks like they're saving power, turning off some of those heaters. So the receiver probably gives you maximum sensitivity as far as its noise figure is concerned by the time you get out there beyond Jupiter or Saturn. After that, the extra distance, the extra cooling, I don't think it matters a whole lot. And the majority of the limitation is downlink limitation, not uplink. Very similar to when, if Jim, for instance, starts using any of the Oscar satellites, the signal that he can send to the satellite by using enough antenna gain and enough transmitter power on the Earth, that's the easy part, uplink. Downlink, there's a finite amount of power, usually only a couple of watts on the satellite, and you're listening with a fairly simple receiver, and so downlink is usually the limitation. In the case of these spacecraft, the 6 or so watts output from that traveling wave tube, from that distance, downlink is your limitation. NASA can always use a bigger transmitter and a bigger dish on the Earth, and even combine dishes as a phased array, as they sometimes do, with the extremely long baseline interferometry. So uplink power is not the problem. Sensitivity of the satellite receiver is not the problem most of the time. Wonder if that helps a little bit there, Tony. WW2W, K2RIW.
Yes, it did, Dick. Thanks. It's a very interesting subject. And it's also not too far from the original question I have. The subject was noise. Noise could be both a nuisance and also a very useful natural phenomenon with which to measure things. In some areas it's a very predictable thing. It's with some sources, like such not predictable, but you have an idea of the background noise of the universe, let's say, so to speak. And I wanted to ask about noise sources used for building things. I know we have noise bridges and so forth, and I've seen many circuits are usually using a Zener diode, which is basically a diode that's deliberately made to break down at a reverse specific voltage by using doping, doping the junction to make it, so to speak, imperfect. And it's a non-destructive avalanche. And in that little region, it generates noise. So my question is, if you want to develop noise, let's say if you're building a 902 megahertz amplifier chain, what device should develop noise way up to that region? And also, does it pay or is it worth it? Or does it even make sense? Let's say if you put a few noise devices, let's say you get 5 Zener diodes, you pad them and sum them into an amplifier. Let's say the MRA-8 that I gave an example of for before, if you use that as an amplifier and sum them all, would you get a wider bandwidth of noise? Could you check each device? Does it vary?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
For the last 20 seconds, Tony timed out, but I'm hearing him on the input, so I got his whole question. Let me backtrack a little bit first. You and I, Tony, let's assume that we're building the world's best receiver, and I want to listen to very weak signals. So common sense would lead you to believe that if I made my receiver with a particular amount of gain, the average receiver has approximately 110 to 120 decibels of gain in between the antenna port and the loudspeaker output. 120 dB is it's 100 billion to 1 power ratio. 90 dB would be 1 billion. 110 would be 100 billion. Between 100 billion and 1,000 billion, almost a trillion to 1. I think 120 dB is a trillion to 1 power ratio. Anyhow, so how weak a signal can your receiver survive? A good 2-meter receiver at half a microvolt of input is going to give you a pretty good response, FM receiver. A good single sideband receiver maybe goes down to a 0.08 or so microvolts, very small amount of signal, will give you a reasonable single sideband signal-to-noise ratio output. And you and I want to build a receiver that's 10 dB more sensitive than that. Good common sense would say, okay, I add 10 dB more gain to the front end. Instead of having a 120 dB gain receiver, I build a 130 dB gain receiver. And you say, why can't I do that? Well, there's a lower diminishing returns. Eventually, you rapidly get to the point where the signal you're listening to is getting weaker and weaker, and what you and I call an acceptable signal really is a certain signal-to-noise ratio. The signal is very predictable. You tell me how many watts the guy is transmitting, how big an antenna he's using, how many miles away he is. You and I can go to a formula and tell you exactly how many microvolts of signal you're going to get out of your receiving site. So signal strength on the input is very deterministic and predictable. That's the good news. The bad news is...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
As that signal gets weaker and weaker, eventually it's competing with what looks like more and more noise. And where's that noise coming from? Your very first amplifier at the front end of that receiver is an amplifier that you've built as best you can, but it can never be perfect. Every amplifier generates noise. The only thing left to talk about is how much noise is your particular transistor creating. Your 2N321 transistor, for instance, is making some amount of noise. The amount of noise it makes is traceable to the bureau, and it's measured by something that's called noise figure. It's a mathematical formula you go to. You go to the right instrumentation, an automatic noise figure meter, which, by the way, was invented by Mr. John Clark of Airborne Instruments Laboratory. I used to work for John Clark at Airborne Instruments Laboratory. It was a fun set of conversations we had. He's the man who originally invented the automatic noise figure indicator. I think he did that work in roughly 1960 or so, before I arrived. And it saved a lot of labor compared to what people did as the alternative. So that laboratory instrumentation will tell you how high is the quality of your receiver, how high is the quality of your first-end amplifier, how much noise is it generating. Because no matter how much gain you put on that receiver downrange, if you're only amplifying your own noise of your own front end, you're not gaining anything beyond a certain point. You rapidly approach a point of diminishing return. That's what usually happens on VHF, UHF receivers. Let me drop. On HF receivers, the background noise of Mother Nature, of the Earth, usually dominates. A good receiver on 2 meters could have a front-end noise figure with carefully chosen transistors of 0.6 decibels of noise figure. The lower the number, the better. So real low noise figure. In other words, electronically, how much noise is that receiver making? You can refer it back to the equivalent noise power of a 50-ohm resistor at some particular temperature. Temperature really is how fast are the molecules moving. The average kinetic energy of the molecules, whether it be the air or the chunk of steel in front of you. What is your thermometer measuring? It's measuring average kinetic energy of motion, of physical translation motion of those molecules. At the molecular level, it's moving. That's what's called temperature. It's hard to believe, but it is. Because they're moving, they're making, and there's electrons in their outer orbits of those molecules. Those electrons are making amount of noise. A 50-ohm resistor sitting at room temperature in your room with good instrumentation, you can easily confirm that it's making an amount of noise power of minus 114 dBm for each megacycle of bandwidth where you make the measurement. That's the funny thing about noise. Noise is not defined because it does not have a carrier frequency. You don't talk about the noise that's at 1 megacycle or the noise that's at 1,000 megacycles. When you're measuring noise, it covers all frequencies in theory. And now, how many megacycles wide is your receiver tells you how much noise power you're going to make. And noise power has got some really funny characteristics. Let me drop. Yes, it's thoroughly random. Each time I flip a coin, nobody on planet Earth, within reason, can tell me, is that next flip going to be a head or a tails? Very small statistics. But if now I'm flipping that coin 1 million times, and it's a really fair coin being flipped in a fair manner, when I do it 1 million times, I'm now getting into very large statistics. With rare exception, you can predict. that exactly half a million will be heads and half a million will be tails, plus or minus a very small percentage when it's large statistics. That's what happens with noise measurement. If I'm making a measurement of noise power and I'm only using a 1 kilohertz wide receiver, first of all, I don't get very much noise, but the noise I get is very ratty. I put a very high gain amplifier on a 1 kilohertz wide receiver, and I put it into a signal strength meter, and the signal strength meter, the needle will be dancing all over the place because I'm only measuring 1,000 evolts events per second because it's a 1 kilohertz wide receiver. I make the receiver 1 megacycle wide, and all of a sudden the amount of dancing of the needle gets very small. I'm getting into large statistics. And in order to make the noise power have very large statistics, radio telescopes done by NASA and National Radio Astronomy Observatory, quite often they use 1,000 megacycles of bandwidth of the receiver. That's 10 to the 9 hertz. Is that large statistics? You're flipping the coin 10 to the 9 times, a billion times on each individual second, and averaging all of that, and now the amount of dancing of the needle gets so small that the needle looks like it's sitting still. You can look at it with a microscope and you won't see the needle moving, so to speak. Or you can put a real high gain amplifier on the S meter and you won't see it moving when the bandwidth is wide enough. As such, a real good radio telescope could be listening to the noise power coming from the star. The noise power coming from the star could be 1,000 times weaker than the noise power of their state-of-the-art receiver. It's 1,000 times weaker, 30 dB below the noise. But by a Dickey switching technique, by, in other words, by having a switch connected to the antenna, connected to that receiver, and you flip back and forth between the dummy load and the antenna looking at that star, you can easily resolve 30 dB below the noise, because your noise is being averaged over such a large number of events, the noise is so steady that the extra noise added from that star, when the antenna is aimed at the star, is 30 dB weaker. You will see the strip chart recorder jump up a little bit, and you'll say, aha, I just measured the noise power from that star. On my antenna, it represents 5 degrees Kelvin of noise power. And you can resolve that. So, again, how weak a signal can you receive? As you can tell by radiometry techniques, that's what I just described to you, radiometry, you'd be amazed how weak it can be done if you have the right equipment and you know what you're doing. Let me drop. Now, Tony's original question was, how do I generate that noise accurately? And how do I know that I'm getting noise at the right frequency? Can I get more noise by combining multiple devices? You could, but I don't recommend you do that. You choose the right device appropriate for the frequency you care about, it will make the noise you care about. If I've got a Zener diode where the junction of the Zener diode is small enough in physical size so that the stray capacitance of it is small enough, if I'm using the right kind of device where the transit time within the device itself is fast enough, if I'm getting down to sub-nanoseconds of transit time within the device, call it rise time of the diode if you know what I mean. If my diode is fast enough so that it could easily do a good job of rectifying at 1,000 megs, and now I use that diode in a Zener manner, I back-bias it, and I back-bias it very lightly. A Zener that's fed the right amount of current is a very steady device, but if I feed too little current into a Zener diode, I'm starving it. It generates extra noise. The amount of noise it generates is predictable. So choose the right device. Choose the right current going into it, and you will be generating noise from 0 to 1,000 megacycles inclusive. And it'll have a little bit of fall off at the high end, but that's predictable. So getting a calibrated amount of noise out of a noise-generating Zener diode, which is the usual way it's done, is quite predictable. As long as you don't have to have extreme accuracy in your noise generator, let me drop. You can pick up a known amplifier, like maybe it's a MAR 6 amplifier, MAR 8 amplifier, one of these little three-terminal amplifiers, where you've got nothing but a 50-ohm resistor on the input of it, as the signal generator, so to speak, and depending on the noise figure of the amplifier, the noise it generates might be 10 dB louder than the noise it gets from the 50-ohm resistor. But all of this is predictable. If you know the noise figure of the device, And there's ways you can find that out. You bring it to an automatic noise figure indicator and measure it. If you know the noise figure of your amplifier, and if your amplifier covers the frequency range you care about, and because the amplifier has got 25 dB of gain, the noise power coming out of that amplifier is 25 dB louder than the noise that's calculatable on the input. So using an amplifier as a noise figure generating device, and maybe two or three amplifiers cascaded together if you want a whole lot of noise power, that's fairly easy to do. For we amateurs, where half a dB of accuracy is usually good enough, that technique works. The guys at National Bureau of Standards, NIST, National Institute of Science and Technology, I think it is, they don't do that because the cascaded amplifiers, you know, the individual amplifiers have aging characteristics, and voltage sensitive and temperature sensitive. Although you can generate a lot of noise with that, it is not highly accurate noise power. An individual noise diode is. A properly designed noise diode gives you a lot less noise, but it's very precise in the amount of noise it gives you if you've done a good design job. And when it comes to an automatic noise figure indicator, the way it works, let me drop, is that you connect to the front end of the amplifier, that's the amplifier under test, you connect it to something like a Zener diode, you turn the Zener diode on and off at usually a 400 hertz rate with a square wave. The Zener diode is producing a known amount of noise. You look at the output noise from the amplifier, and you'll see a known amount of delta. In other words, when the noise power of the signal of the Zener diode is turned on, you'll see a certain amount of noise power. Turn the Zener diode off, and you see less noise power. The ratio of noise on and noise off, I can't think of the letter they use for that now, K factor, I think it is. Anyhow, the dB of delta coming out of the amplifier with a known amount of noise power being turned on and off at the input, you go to the right formula, it tells you what is the noise figure of the amplifier. Let me show you why. Assuming that my amplifier was perfect, assuming that the noise power of my noise generator was, the really good ones are 15.6 dB of TXS. In other words, a good noise generator generates noise approximately 15.6 decibels louder than a 50 ohm resistor at 290 degrees Kelvin. 290 Kelvin is the IEEE standard temperature that everyone has settled on, which is around 21, I think it is, degrees centigrade. Anyhow, 290 Kelvin is the reference temperature that's used for noise figure measurements. So when your noise generator is turned off, it's making an amount of noise of a 50 ohm resistor at 290. When it's turned on, it's 15 dB louder. I'm going to round off the numbers. If your preamplifier was perfect, the noise power ratio of on to off coming out of your amplifier would be 15 dB. If my noise figure of my amplifier gets worse and worse, if my amplifier is generating 15...
repeater, timeout, cancel.
If now my preamplifier, let me drop... If my preamplifier, I'm rounding off the numbers, had 15 decibels of noise figure, it's making noise 15 dB louder than a room temperature resistor. And my noise meter is making, when it's turned on, my noise diode is making 15 dB of TXS. I got 15 dB of excess noise continuously coming from the preamplifier. I got 15 dB of noise figure, noise power being turned on and off during the test. When I add the two together, 15 plus 15, so to speak, is 18 when you convert it to power, 3 dB more, 3.01 dB more, I will see a ratio out of only 3 dB on that particular yucky amplifier that has a 15 dB noise figure, because the noise power being turned on and off is equal to the noise power the amplifier is generating. And when I add the two together, when it's on, I get a 3 dB increase. As the amplifier gets better and better, the 3 dB of delta on the output will go to 15 dB. I will see the exact on-off noise ratio of the noise diode as my amplifier goes toward perfection. It gives you a thumbnail sketch of how an automatic noise figure operates, how a noise generator operates, why is noise figure of an amplifier so important, and as you make that amplifier more and more perfect so it generates less and less noise, it can listen to weaker and weaker signals. I probably went off on a couple of tangents from your original question, But making precise amount of noise, Tony, choose the right device, and the problem goes away. There's one other problem I should mention to you.
How you doing?
I'm hearing you very well, Andy, W2CDL, who just said, how are you doing? Do you want to tell us something, Andy? Go ahead. Yeah, sometimes Andy comes through another channel. The one thing wrong with that noise diode that I just described to you, assume that my particular Zener makes 15 dB of TXS, and assume that I adjust it just right so that while it's turned on, it is a 50-ohm impedance source of noise signal. That's the good news. When I turn it off, I'm no longer putting any voltage into that Zener diode. It's now a perfect open circuit. Except for a little bit of stray capacitance, it's got a resistive component of infinity. And now my amplifier front end is first seeing a signal coming from a 50-ohm source, and then it's seeing an open circuit. And the way most gas-fed amplifiers in particular behave is that the apparent noise figure changes when you change the input impedance. There's an ideal impedance your gas-fed amplifier wants to see in order for it to give the best noise figure performance. And by the way, it's rarely 50 ohms. So when you're designing that noise figure source, you've got another criteria that's difficult to meet. That is, you want the noise on and noise off impedance of your noise generator to stay 50 ohms. Otherwise, you're getting another error term in your measurement that's not easy to live with. The way they usually get around that is to start off with a noise source that has, let me pick a number, 35 dB of TXS when it's turned on, make it a very noisy diode, carefully choosing the right voltage and the right currents and whatever. You can make the diode very noisy. Start off with 35 dB of TXS, followed by a 20 decibel resistive attenuator. Now the 35 dB after attenuation goes down to plus 15 from plus 35. Because it's going through a 20 dB attenuator, now if I carefully measure the impedance, noise on and noise off, it'll probably go from 50 ohms to 50.5 ohms, and therefore that impedance change characteristic.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Therefore that impedance change characteristic has almost been wiped out. So by way of your amplification, you can do that. By way of having enough amplification on your not-so-perfect noise generator, making a whole lot of noise and putting an attenuator after it, you can make the impedance stay constant as you turn the front end of that noise generator on and off. WW2W, K2RIW. Go ahead, Tony.
Yeah, K2RIW, Whiskey, in Bayridge, Brooklyn. All right, thanks, Dick. I've been taking notes here. 290K, 21C. I like the idea of padding down a known source, 20 dB, as a better comparative source. Yeah, I know. You look at somebody's Smith charts with the, you know, all the S parameters going in for the lowest noise figure. I mean, you really knock your head against the wall with a lot of that stuff. So, having dealing with known sources, and you know, when you're dealing with it, it's much easier to deal with a delta than with absolute values. At least you're dealing with comparing to a known with a varying quantity. Also, it's what I basically wanted to do was I have a spectrum analyzer adapter. Actually, a lot of us have spectrum analyzers to some degree. We don't realize it, but when we operate PSK and a lot of these DSP computer monitor displays, you can actually see the noise. When you hit your CW filter in there kicking in, you can see the brightness of the noise all of a sudden become much more narrower on the screen. So you're basically looking at the noise representation of your receiver as audio coming out. And so I wanted to, let me drop it. Be able to develop amplifier chains or even discrete device chains for outputs, to clean up spectrum by putting noise through it and looking at the oscilloscope where you could tweak the device where you could actually see where it rolls off or where you want the energy to be. And so I don't need an exact, to know an exact amount for that particular purpose, but from what also, you know, for using a noise source, like you said, as a noise figure determining device, it sounds very interesting. And yeah, I was also wondering about the capacitance of the junction that would determine, you know, the roll-off of generating the noise. So perhaps it could use an MRA device to develop noise itself to feed into something, you know, not another MRA, but because you know that they have very high frequency transit the devices, they work way up there. All right, let me, I thank you very much for that information, Dick, and thanks for, and I wanted to, maybe you could also give me more information on Mel's Corner. I wanted to put that in our next newsletter about the Limebox TechNet running, I guess, you know, something in memoriam for Mel. I'm sure he still has he probably has a big pileup of mail that he tried to get to, but, you know, he did his really unbelievable job in getting to that mail the past few months before he passed on. Back to Nat, WWW.
Yeah, when you go to the Limebox website, you will see a memorial write-up about Mel in those blue bar section, the bottom of the blue bars under the silent key section. And maybe you guys would want to add to that from the Kings County Radio Club, which I think you're a member of, Tony. I rounded off the numbers, by the way. 290 Kelvin is the reference temperature for all IEEE referenced automatic noise figure indicators. Since the absolute zero temperature is minus 273.1, I think it is, the ratio between those two is 22.9. So it looks to me like the reference temperature for noise figure measurements, which is 290 Kelvin, is very close to 23 degrees centigrade, which is something like 62 degrees Fahrenheit. Why they chose a temperature that, by my standards, is below room temperature, 62 Fahrenheit to me is lower. Most people would like to have a room at 70 degrees Fahrenheit, but that's the reference they chose. And so it's something that's easily achievable, I guess, in an air-conditioned laboratory, maybe how they did it. But understanding noise figure measurements, noise in a receiver, and so on, very important subject. And when it comes to almost every spectrum analyzer, let me drop. Let's see, for I guess it was 6 years, I worked for the Spectrum Analyzer Division of Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and I worked on the design of the so-called 707 Spectrum Analyzer, which became 727 and 730, 747, and so on. One of the things we discovered at that time, and I don't think it's changed a lot since, is that most spectrum analyzers have a mixer front end, particularly on the lowest range that goes from 0 to 2 gigs. Almost every crystal front end spectrum analyzer has a sensitivity of around minus 85 dBm when using the 1 megacycle resolution bandwidth filter. Minus 85 dBm with 1 megacycle. You go through the numbers, that is very close to a 30 decibel noise figure. So in other words, almost every barefoot spectrum analyzer makes a very nice receiver in that it's very broadband. Some of them go from DC to light almost. That's the good news. But as a receiver, it's nice and flat, calibrated, but not sensitive. It's got a nearly 30 decibel noise figure. So to get full sensitivity out of a spectrum analyzer, you're going to want to add something close to 30 decibels of preamplification gain in front of it, and you'd like it to be a low noise amplifier. Now you can make it 30 decibels more sensitive, if you know what I mean. So spectrum analyzers make very nice receivers, but you got to worry about the sensitivity. Some of the better ones made these days will have a button you press on the front panel that when you press the button, it turns on a preamplifier, and with flipping of relays, it installs it in the front end. The good news of using the preamplifier is you have more sensitivity. The bad news is now the preamplifier has got its frequency response, its peaks and valleys, its noise figure, its a standing wave ratio and whatever, so it adds some extra calibration problems. So calibrating the spectrum analyzer when the preamplifier is being used is a little bit more troublesome. You can make a spectrum analyzer that's super flat, and you can make a spectrum analyzer that's very sensitive with a preamplifier. But in general, you cannot make a super flat, super sensitive spectrum analyzer. In the old, old days, it's like asking for an Einstein brain installed inside of a rectal Welch body. Or maybe you choose somebody more modern, but you know what I mean. You don't get that combination, with rare exception. Okay, John was the next guy with a question. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Yes, Dick, a real quick question. I know you follow Scientific American. Last week, a bulletin came up on that weekly notice about the Moore's Law, and the it's going to run out. But they found a way to change the architecture, and I was wondering if you read that article.
Yeah, I think I skimmed it. I don't remember seeing it. And by the way, Moore's Law, Mr. Moore of the Intel Corporation came up with that law that every 18 months or so you're going to double the number of transistors you put on a chip, and as such, we're putting, you know, millions of them on a chip now on some of these microprocessors, and double every 18 months. And so he started that in roughly 1968 or so, and people on probably five or eight occasions since then have said, okay, we're going to run out. Well, each time that you thought you're going to run out, somebody comes up with another piece of technology, final lithography, X-ray lithography, direct ion implantation, electron painting, if you know what I mean. They always find ways of making the transistor smaller. We're getting down to the molecular level of the transistors, and can they be made at some molecular level? Is an interesting question. So it's just like when I guess it was George Burns said something along the lines of predictions about my death are premature. Predictions of the death of Moore's Law are always premature. There's always another way. And I think it's never going to end with a bang. It's going to end with a slight whimper. When Moore's Law finally runs out, what we're going to discover is that we double the number of devices per chip, not in every 18 months, but every 2 years. It'll run out slowly, if you know what I mean. It's not going to suddenly stop. There's too many years of history now. Let me think. From 1968, so for 40 some odd years, Moore's Law has held constant. And you plot it as a graph on log paper. It's a nice 45 degree line of number of chips versus number of years. So I've forgotten the exact detail. Is it something to do with nanotechnology and sub what's the word now? Submolecular level of the transistors? Is that what's going?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Is that approximately what's going on? Give us a thumbnail sketch of that article, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. I figured you'd looked at that because the problem with the architecture is the wiring and the connections. So now they have found a way, I believe it was some university, deposition by atomic structure itself, laying one atom next to another. They can make wires one atom thick. Isn't that amazing what they could do? And by the way, that was Mark Twain that made that quote. But one atom. So the next question was, well, if they need a little more to carry current, they said they can do two atoms wide. But can you imagine laying it down? Deposition by atomic structure. Fantastic.
Yeah, I think I remember seeing a picture that was done with a scanning electron microscope of the structure that they were constructing one atom at a time. And I believe the shortest piece of wire they could make was one atom wide and something like eight atoms long. I think when they went any shorter than eight atoms long, they didn't stay in place. They jumped out of place. These little things are persnickety. You know, everything at the molecular level is continuously moving. It's called thermal temperature. This average kinetic energy. I mean, so it takes a certain number of molecules assembled in a particular way to make a structure that is quasi-stable. And I vaguely remember eight atoms long, or was it 12 atoms long, was the minimum length. Is that approximately right, John? Go ahead.
Yes, it was, Dick. Just the fact that they were working with atoms, one at a time, depositing them one at a time, to get to these points, they said that's going to extend Moore's Law right there because the architecture is going to change radically. And they think this will all be within the next 2 or 3 years. They'll be actually putting this stuff in production.
By the way, I called it a scanning electron microscope. That's not quite what it is. It is a scanning tunneling electron microscope. You can't make an image out of something at this level, because the word image implies you're using light, and light has wavelengths. I mean, the optical light you are using to look at the stuff in your room right now has a center frequency of 550 nanometers. And we're talking about something here that is sub-nanometer. I mean, a individual molecule, we're getting down to the angstrom level, which is a tenth of a nanometer. So the objects you're building are in the vicinity of a tenth of a nanometer in diameter, the individual molecules, and you're constructing an array of them on the surface of a piece of silicon, for instance, and you'd like to be able to view that with light that is 5,000 times bigger in wavelength than the thing you want to look at. Obviously, you ain't going to see it. But you can mechanically make an extremely sharp point of some material, call it a straight pin if you know what I mean, but it's a super sharp straight pin. You very carefully scan that across the surface, and as you get close enough, with a little bit of voltage difference between your straight pin and the substrate, some electrons decide to tunnel between your straight pin and the substrate, between the object you're looking at. And now you carefully adjust the height of the straight pin at each position in X and Y until you get a given amount of tunneling electrons. And you keep track of the altitude that's doing that. So you slowly make yourself, by scanning X and Y, by a raster scan with this technique, you make a three-dimensional map. You make a map that looks like it's got some mountains to it, and that's the objects you're looking at. So physically, you're measuring the altitude of objects that you cannot see with not even X-ray eyes, if you know what I mean. X-ray meaning a much higher frequency with a wavelength of...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
To really resolve that with optics, let me drop. You'd have to be using a wavelength that's at least 5,000 times shorter. You'd have to be using an optical frequency 5,000 times higher than optical light. You're not going to do that with a normal lens. You start getting into those deep X-ray wavelengths, and what you call lens, those X-rays say, I don't give a damn that you call that a lens. It just goes pouring right through there. It ain't going to focus anymore. You try to make a lens at X-rays, and your X-rays just go right through the lens, if you know what I mean. Life gets difficult. You got to use other techniques. Now, we're about to go into the deeper subject. And Don tonight, Don N2, what can I think about? N2LDY, made the scientific measurement of a traffic light, which has got a lot of... I mean, we amateurs are interested in all kinds of things. And I've often said that we are scientists. And... It's a slightly long definition, but I'm going to give you guys the definition by what I think is the defining organization, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. I remember when I used to subscribe to that magazine way back in February 10th issue, 1984, way in the dark ages, February 10th issue, in their editorial page, on the first page with the masthead. They defined science, engineering, and technology. I'll just read you the science section. It's a little bit lengthy. It goes on for a fairly long paragraph. However, as you listen to this paragraph, you suddenly realize that the word science and scientist, what is a person who claims he's to be a scientist, what is he doing? A guy that's trying to conduct some science. What is science? What these guys define it. Listen to how broadband is this definition. That's why it struck me at the time. Let me drop. So according to the February 10th issue, 1984, I'm just going to tell you the definition of science by the AAAS. Science is the process of investigation of physical, biological, behavioral, social, economic, and political phenomena. It's the process of investigating those things. That's science. Process is used in the collective sense, encompassing everything the investigator does, from the selection of the phenomena to be investigated, to the measurement of the validity of the results, and it includes the selection of the methodology, the selection of the instrumentation, the delineation of the protocol, the execution of the protocol, the production of data,